Hi, Joshua.
How are you, Robert? Very good to be with you again.
I'm good. Thanks for joining us. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. You are Joshua Landis, and I feel we're very lucky to have you today because you're one of the country's leading experts on Syria.
Well, thank you.
Well, it's true. You write the blog Syria Comment. You teach at the University of Oklahoma, and of course, Syria is in the news. As we tape this, it seems pretty much inevitable that the U.S. is going to strike Syria. And it may have already happened by the time this shows up. I don't know. I gather your reading is that indeed a military strike is inevitable at this point.
I do believe so. I think it's a national interest to uphold these international norms on not using chemical weapons. The United States has spoken out very firmly on this. Everybody has positioned themselves to do it, even though Britain has voted against it. Obama seems to have launched on this this course, and the world is expecting it.
And, you know, apparently the plan is to make it a very finite strike that's designed to deter another use of chemical weapons by the regime, but designed not to get the United States involved more deeply in Syria. Do you think it's going to be easy to do that, or do you think there's a real risk that things could get out of hand?
Well, we've seen Israel strike Syria a number of times, blown up a lot of their higher-grade weapons, missiles, and so forth, and Syria has not struck back. So that could be, you know, Syria's engaged in this very brutal and civil war. The last thing they need to do is to get into a fight with the United States and suck America in. Chances are they'll give America a pass. On the other hand, Assad is a master of indirection. He could decide to hit back indirectly using a third proxy, you know, group, like a Palestinian group, hit at Jordan. That would be one of the more obvious places. It's vulnerable. The Jordanian economy is in terrible shape. Jordanians are very upset at their government for assisting American special forces and the Saudis' efforts in Syria. They want to stay out of this, and there have been widespread petitions in Jordan to the king to stay out of it. But, you know, they could blow up a hotel in Amman, especially a hotel where special forces are hanging out. I was there this summer, and there were several hotels where there were a lot of muscly guys looking young and handsome. And that would be a way to hurt America and Jordan in one blow. Lebanon, stir up sectarian problems. We saw them, there was a big car bomb in Turkey this summer, Rihanli, 40 people killed. It turned Turkish public opinion against Erdogan quite briskly because Turks said, why are we getting sucked into a war in Syria? We don't care about Syria that much, and this is not our war. So, you know, Assad has ways to kick back at the neighbors that are supporting the United States in this.
But it sounds like you think it would be if there was retaliation, it would be something without a return address, so to speak. In other words, it wouldn't be an overt strike by the Syrian military.
No, I don't. I think the odds against that are very high. It would only suck America into a direct war, and that would be devastating for Syria.
Now, what about a scenario where the precedent that this sets makes it hard to keep the U.S. from, you know, doing something again weeks or months from now? I mean, let's say there is another chemical weapons attack by the regime, or let's say there's a false flag chemical weapons attack by the rebels. I would think, in a way, a U.S. strike would actually kind of incentivize the rebels, you know, to create some sort of false effect like that if they could. But anyway, what about that whole realm of possibilities?
You know, that's obviously the danger for the United States. The biggest danger is that once you set up this regime of American punishment for using weapons of mass destruction, then you have to follow it up and do it again every time he uses them. And in this bloody civil war where his back is against the wall, the incentives for him to use to reach for these chemical weapons, which are right there, they're free, he's got access to them, and they kill lots of enemies, is going to be extraordinarily high. After all, in any wartime situation, you know, what you want to do is kill as many of your enemies as you can and as quickly as you can. And we saw this, you know, in the Second World War, where America used the atom bomb, firebombed Dresden, was killing 100,000 people at a whack in order to destroy their enemy. The incentives are very high to do this on both sides, but the regime has tons of chemical weapons, and it's going bankrupt. It can't get lots of new weapons that are effective from its allies.
Is that right? Why not? I mean, would Russia and Iran not be willing in principle to supply more?
Well, they are supplying more, but they're not going to supply them at the level that Syria wants. I mean, I'm sure Syria is calling up every day saying, send us this, send us that. And, you know, at some point you begin to, you know, you're just not going to do it anymore. And and I'm sure, you know, Iran opened up a line of credit for $3.5 billion about a month ago, and I'm sure that's going dry. And how much Iran is willing to supply, I don't know, but I'm sure there's a limit to it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Iran, at least the president, is not sounding like he wants to use the U.S. strike as a provocation, right? I mean, it sounds like he would like to kind of overlook it, lest it get in the way of negotiations on the nuclear issue. Is that, I mean, not that he's the one ultimately in charge in Iran, but in any event, is that your reading of the situation?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think both Obama and the new president of Iran are trying to get to some kind of talks. They want to avoid war between Iran and the United States. They want to come to some new understanding. But Syria is standing in the middle of that, and it's going to be very hard to get over it because as you say, the forces that be in Iran have doubled down on Syria. Syria is extremely important. It is the byway towards Hezbollah, which is the jewel in the crown for Iran in the Arab world. They're not going to let those things go down the tubes. And so, you know, it makes it very difficult for the United States and Iran to have any dialogue and come to any kind of meeting of the minds.
Although in the long run, if you imagine a grand bargain type deal with Iran, a kind of rapprochement with the U.S., then those assets would become less important to Iran, right?
Oh, you know, it's hard. You know, Iran and the United States don't trust each other. They're unlikely to trust each other with these present, you know, with the government of Iran the way it is, and the United States, I guess, the way it is. But it's hard to see how Iran would ever allow Hezbollah, the Syrian regime, and its, you know, its reach and its support for Shiites throughout the Middle East to wane. I think they've got a lot invested in this, and they don't trust the United States. And if they allow those forces to be shut down, if the United States and Iran got at loggerheads again, they would have nothing.
Mm-hmm. So what can you say a little more about the motivation for hanging on to those assets? I mean, is it a sense that that does Iran think that it would be imperiled, its national security would be imperiled if it didn't have the kind of reach afforded by the alliance with Syria, Hezbollah, and so on?
Yeah, I think, you know, its national security profile is based on being able to have some allies that give it much greater reach, because Iran is fairly weak on its own. It's trying to develop some kind of nuclear option, it would seem. But it has these allies. It has allies in Shiite groups throughout the Middle East. And that has discomfited Saudi Arabia. It certainly makes it's paralyzed the Arab League because it's got an ally in Iraq. Hezbollah has got Lebanon pretty well locked up. And Assad is in Syria. So, you know, three major Arab countries are allies of Iran. And Saudi Arabia doesn't like it. The Sunni powers in general don't like it at all. And the United States and Israel hate it. So it gives Iran some real reach. And it makes Iran a valuable ally of Russia and other people, too, because it's a player. The United States has to go, cannot get around Iran.
Okay. And back to the kind of chemical weapons issue. One thing, I don't know if you've seen it, but one thing that was released about the time that John Kerry spoke today was a map of where around Damascus there were reports of chemical weapons people being victimized by chemical weapons. They acknowledge that the map is very imprecise. In some cases, the reports may have come from people who had traveled to hospitals before making the report, whatever. I don't know. Have you seen the map, first of all?
You know, I've heard about the map, but it was designed to show what to show what the, you know, where rockets had been shot from and where they went, to show that these rockets were shot from government-controlled territories. And that, you know, it was part of the evidence put forward, this four-page document put forward to prove to the world why the U.S. feels confident that it was Assad who was the author of this chemical attack and why it's going to get whacked by the United States.
Now, Kerry actually said, we know where the missiles came from, we know where they landed. The map they released actually doesn't show where the missiles came from, but he did assert that we know that. There's been a lot of puzzlement, a certain amount, about why Assad would have done this. Can you explain a little bit about why it might have made strategic sense? I mean, leaving aside the problem that it provoked the United States, assuming he thought he could get away with a chemical weapons attack, it would have made a kind of strategic sense. Am I right?
Yes. Well, I mean, you're trying to kill your enemies, and these weapons are good at killing people. You know, as I said, the United States has done this before in the Second World War. You just want to kill your enemy. I mean, that's the logic of it, unfortunately. Plus, you know, other people have suggested that Saudi anti-aircraft missiles had been snuck into, you know, through these special forces and through the training programs with Syrian opposition in Jordan, that they had been snuck into the Ghouta. Several Syrian MiG planes have been shot down only in the week before this event took place. And they were not flying over the Ghouta. So the regime was a bit flummoxed because it couldn't use its superior air power to begin to strike at these new places that were popping up, these new rebel centers that were popping up just on the outskirts of Damascus. And so then chemical missiles become, you know, your best option. That's the logic of war here. And everybody is trying to get the upper hand on the others and use better weapons. And the better weapons have proliferated, and they're more and more getting into Syria. And so this pushes the regime to use its chemical weapons.
Okay. So that's a little different from the rationale I had kind of imagined. I hadn't heard about the thing where their aircraft were suddenly imperiled, the aircraft that had been striking this very area. And I was imagining, you know, because I had heard that this was one of the big remaining rebel stronghold in the immediate Damascus vicinity. And so I assumed it would be an attempt to actually, you know, empty the neighborhood. I mean, maybe something like ethnic cleansing, which is one thing chemical weapons are effective at.
That's true. And it's also, you know, that is the end of the line for Assad, is a sort of cordon sanitaire around the core of Damascus. Because the way Damascus is designed, it's a city of about 5 million people, if you add in all of the suburbs, is that the rich people live in the center. It's a little bit like Paris. The rich people live in the center, and as you go further and further out, you get to poorer and poorer neighborhoods that are people who've recently crowded into the cities. And these are largely Sunni. So they are, you know, hotbeds or potential hotbeds for rebellion. And this is largely a countryside movement against the cities in one aspect. There's a sectarian aspect too, but there is a countryside versus city, poor versus rich. Mm-hmm. And so what we see is that these outer suburbs of Damascus have been, you know, have opened themselves to rebels and the rebel movements, and especially as Homs was destroyed in the north, Daraa in the south, these people fled into the suburbs of Damascus, and they began to welcome the opposition into those suburbs as well. So Assad, you know, if he cannot quiet and intimidate these neighborhoods into shutting up, is going to then carry out some kind of ethnic cleansing, as you say. I mean, it's not ethnic cleansing per se, because he's got tons of Sunnis within his government. But it is wiping out these neighborhoods and trying to drain the ocean. You know, in the classic anti-guerrilla tactics, you try to drain the ocean in which the fish are swimming. And that's, you know, that's the horrifying end of the line is that you just empty out a cordon sanitaire around Damascus in which rebels can no longer shoot missiles at you to downtown Damascus. And you just push, as they get better and better howitzers or mortars, you begin driving them further and further outwards in order to keep this no man's land between you and them. And that's what's creating so many refugees in Jordan. And that's where we're headed if there's no end to this civil war.
Mm-hmm. Now, there have been allegations by the regime that the rebels have used chemical weapons. Of course, the regime is claiming that this was a rebel, was staged by the rebels. But beyond that, they're claiming that the rebels had used it in the past. And in fact, they got these UN inspectors who have not yet, as we tape, issued their report. But they got the UN inspectors actually, I think, visit some places that they claimed had shortly before this more widely publicized chemical weapons attack, the regime claims that the rebels had staged chemical weapons attacks there. Is there, what is the evidence on whether the rebels have actually used chemical weapons?
There's very little evidence. We have two, in earlier episodes, a fairly high official in the UN came out and said it was not clear that Assad was using them, and he murkied up the picture a little bit. The second piece of evidence is that the Turks claimed to have, and this was reported widely in Turkish press, I was in Turkey at the time, beginning of June, the Turks claimed that they caught al-Qaeda members in Ankara in possession of these canisters of sarin gas. Mm-hmm. So that was, but we didn't hear very much about it. It was on Turkish national television, it was reported in the Turkish papers, but it didn't have a lot of resonance. But since this episode broke out, people have been emailing these articles around, trying to suggest that the opposition has and could have used. The trouble is, in this latest chemical weapons attacks, is there, you know, there were at least 10 rockets being set off into the neighborhoods. Now, if this was a false flag operation by the rebels, mm-hmm. it would have taken at least 100 rebels, the rebel leaders, to engage in this bigger operation. That means they all have to keep this conspiracy secret to themselves, not let mm-hmm. it leak out. And they're killing their own people, after all. So mm-hmm. they would have to be, you know, killing 1,000 of their own people. The dangers of that and of the story leaking out, because the rebels are going to be horrified if they discover that their leaders are killing thousands of their own people in order to carry out a false flag thing. So the chances that this would leak out and that those rebel leaders would be assassinated in their beds or have knives stuck in their backs by angry Sunnis is very high, yeah. it seems to me. I mean, it doesn't seem very credible.
Well, and they would have been possibly triggering the evacuation of their most important stronghold in the Damascus area, right?
I mean, it doesn't make sense. Once you start really thinking about it, it just seems yeah. crazy.
Yeah. So where can you bring us up to date on, like, how grim the situation already was going into this? Leave aside the chemical weapons. I mean, I gather that, first of all, the regime some months ago got its second wind, apparently. There had been a period when everyone thought, we're just counting the days until the regime falls. You had, I think, you know, presciently from the beginning said that people were, in general, overestimating the vulnerability of the regime and that this was not going to happen in a few months, you know, the fall of the regime. Well, you not only were you right, but there was actually, I think, a kind of a shift of momentum some months ago. And it seemed that the momentum was back in the regime's direction. And then more recently than that, I'm not really clear on the state of things. How would you summarize the state of play?
Well, earlier this summer, al-Qaeda weighed in and threw its shoulder to the wheel here, joining the Syrian army. And that gave a real boost in morale and the quality of fighting. And we saw in Qusay, out of this important town that had been a center of a pocket of resistance near the Lebanese border, got completely devastated. And Hezbollah, you know, weighed in with about 150 or so of its own fighters being killed there. So they made a major, you know, they made a major investment in this.
Right, and that was Hezbollah. You initially said al-Qaeda, but I think you meant Hezbollah,
no,
right?
Hezbollah. I'm very sorry, right. Not al-Qaeda at all. Hezbollah,
right.
Lebanese Shiites, mm-hmm. and Iran and so forth, helped, you know, bolster the Syrian regime. And that looked like But it underscores that the Syrian regime is tough, and this army has become, in many ways, an Alawite militia. Of course, there's a lot of Sunnis and Christians and other minorities that are still loyal to the regime and are fighting for it. But at the very heart of it is the Alawite minority that feels like it's going to be ethnically cleansed if it loses to these Islamist militias that have become mm-hmm. so powerful in the opposition. So we're in a classic, you know, nationalist ethnic civil war here, and both sides feel like they're going to be ethnically cleansed, and that they. So this is going to go on for a long time. It's a zero-sum game for both sides. They're not going to put their arms down. Very hard for them to come to any kind of agreement because they see each other as monsters. The opposition, even the Free Syrian Army, is regularly in their YouTubes calling the Alawites, the Alawite regime, Majus, Nizam Majusi, and Majus is like the Magi in the kings of Orient and so forth. It's a term to designate Zoroastrians, the pre-Muslim Iranians. So not only does it say that these Alawites are kafir, they're unbelievers, but that they're not even Arabs. They're Persians, and they're crypto-Persians. So, and the Alawites have done the same thing to the Sunnis. They're claiming that all these rebels are Al-Qaeda-linked Islamist extremists who are being paid by Saudi Arabia and Israel and America to come in and kill, you know, good Syrians. And so just let's 1 second. Excuse me.
Sure.
So this is the, I'm sorry, I left my phone on. So this is the problem, is they both othered each other. The level of hatred, misunderstanding, and there is no Syrian nation left. Both of these sides have, in a sense, defined each other as being outside the realm of the nation. And that makes it very hard to compromise and once again sew up the differences. Mm-hmm. So that's why this is going on for a long time, because there's a lot of people who still are supporting the regime. There are a lot of people who've gotten disgusted with the opposition because it hasn't unified, I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's hard to evade electronic notifications.
I hope that takes care of it. Forgive
we'll
me, Robert,
see.
For
I'm
being...
sure the next one will be coming from my end, but,
well,
but yeah, you're probably good.
The opposition has been completely divided. There's over 1,000 militias, and the FSA, the American-backed wing of this opposition, is really an organization that contracts out to other militias, and with money and arms, it can buy their allegiance and their cooperation in various operations. Mm-hmm. But they aren't the dominant force. The biggest mm-hmm. fighting forces are the Islamic Front and the Al-Qaeda militias who've been at the forefront of every major rebel victory and have been carrying doing the heavy lifting. They're the ones who've marched into the Alawite territory. They were the ISI and Jabhat al-Nusra, that's the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or the Levant, mm-hmm. and Jabhat al-Nusra, both linked to Al-Qaeda. They mm-hmm. swept into the Alawite Mountains, took over about 12 villages for a brief period of time. They were pushed back, but this was a dramatic reversal of fortune against the regime just about 3-4 weeks ago, at the same time that the rebels took a big air base north of Aleppo, Manar Air Base. And mm-hmm. once again, it was foreign mujahideen, jihadist fighters who spearheaded this attack in cooperation with the Free Syrian Army, the pro-American guys. So the pro-American guys had to join forces with these foreign jihadists in order to capture this air base. And it was spectacular because a Saudi suicide bomber, foreign jihadist, drove this giant truck of TNT or some explosive into the gates of this government stronghold air base that the rebels have been trying to take for years, a year and a half, and blew a giant hole in it and sent up the big mushroom cloud. The videos were very spectacular. And afterwards, the FSA chief, a guy, Abdel-Jabbar al-Aghidi, who is like the number two guy in the FSA or number three. He's certainly a go-to guy for the Americans. They've given most, funneled most of their aid through him. He's the head of the Aleppo district. And he thanked, in a victory tape afterwards, he thanked these foreign jihadists profusely. Mm-hmm. And this is the problem. It's the close alliance between the Al-Qaeda-linked groups and the Free Syrian Army that has paralyzed America. And that's why Dempsey, our chief of staff, has said, we don't really have a partner in these opposition people. If they take over, they're going to be anti-American, and they may get the chemical weapons. So in a sense, what he was saying is we'd rather have Assad have the chemical weapons than these foreign fighters. And that's the dilemma for the United States. They don't want Assad to use the chemical weapons. They're going to punish him, but they don't want to destroy his regime because they'd prefer to have him have them than the rebels. And that's where we stand today. I mean, that's the, you know, once you peel away all the jargon and everything else, that's where we stand. And that's a pretty sad story about the state of Syria. So we've got a lot of fighting. America is helping the rebels to a limited degree so that they don't lose, but they're not giving them enough help so that they can destroy the Assad regime. And that means that America essentially is you know, structuring this, that the civil war goes on for a long time.
Yeah, that really sounds like it almost is the case, that we're, you know, we're just trying to, you know, the effect of our policy is to sustain the civil war and let neither side gain a decisive edge. You know, and I've got to say, at the risk of editorializing, that that's kind of grotesque, you know? I mean...
But we did the Iran-Iraq war. I mean, it was the same strategy. Is, you know, we didn't want either side to win. And it is.
Yeah, but
is,
I mean, grotesque. But I mean, is that so different morally? I mean, if sustaining a civil war means that thousands and thousands more will die while you're doing it, is that a whole lot worse than killing 1,000 people with chemical weapons? I'm sorry. I'm just not... It's not obvious to me.
Well, but you know, I'll let you do the editorializing.
yeah, okay, I'll keep you out of this. But it just...
No, obviously, it's not a good policy for the United States to be engaged in. There's no doubt about it. And on the other hand, what are the options for the U.S.? This is where I think people in Washington are scratching their head. Is they don't see a way out of this. They don't see a partner in the opposition, and they are dedicated to, you know, Obama, the president, has said, we will not accept the Assad regime, and we're not going to make peace with him. And
yeah, well, this is just a totally incoherent policy. I'm sorry, but I mean, if we decided that a rebel victory would be inimical to the interests of the U.S., and it sounds like, from what you're saying, that's the case... And we've also said that the current government cannot stand. I don't understand what our preferred outcome is.
Well, you know, what this leads to is the division of Syria into different states. Is you, in a sense, you get the battle lines begin to freeze. And the Assad regime today owns the west coast of Syria, which is along the Mediterranean between Lebanon and Turkey, and in a swath of land that comes down from Homs, Hama, the third and fourth city, down to Damascus and towards the south. So it owns the western and southern part of the country. The rebels own the north, Aleppo, the second biggest city, or the sort of other big city in Syria, and out east towards Deir ez-Zor and so forth. And the country is essentially split into two. The Kurds own a little hunk of land the northeast, between Iraq and Turkey. So what you could see is that certainly the country splitting into two and possibly three with an Alawite-dominated government that's also ruling over Damascus, a Sunni city, but in which the minorities are once again a much bigger percentage of the population than they were before. Because before, Syria is 60%, firmly 60% Sunni Arab, and only 20% minorities, 12% of them being the Alawites who are doing the heavy lifting for the minorities. But the minorities were becoming smaller and smaller. The Christians have been leaving. They're only about 5%. They always say 10 to 12, but it's really about 5. the minorities are becoming a smaller percentage of the overall Syrian population, which has been increasing by leaps and bounds. Mm-hmm. And now, if the country splits in half, you know, the minorities can hang on to power in the south, but the big hunks of the Sunni population are then separated off with their own state, and that's what they have to get organized, and where there's 1,000 militias. And that's where America can do some good, is trying to help this, you know, liberated soi-disant territory where the government is no longer holds sway, where the rebels own the north, to mm-hmm. help them get a government together and begin feeding the people and setting up school systems and all mm-hmm. the other ministries and social services that a real government has to provide, so that it's mm-hmm. not a lawless territory the way it is today.
Okay, so this is a partition scenario where and
that's the way it is today. I mean, yeah. And if this logjam or this stalemate goes on, which it looks like it will for some time, we're going to end up with two different territories.
Yeah, but I have not heard America yet pursuing that as a goal. I mean, it sounds to me
it's not the goal. It's not the express goal. America wants a negotiated outcome to this. That's what it says. Geneva II. They claim, and Kerry reiterated it today, that the long-term goal of the United States remains a power-sharing, negotiated settlement between, you know, they don't want Assad to be doing it, but, you know, they don't have any choice over that, between the old state and the rebel forces.
Yeah.
That doesn't look very viable today.
And no, I mean, it's partition seems a much more plausible near-term solution than some kind of negotiated settlement, right?
I mean, it's possible after a decade or two that these two sides would begin to, you know, through commerce, through general cultural closeness and everything, would re-knit relations.
Absolutely it is. And that can happen with partition. And the argument is you know, when you have clear kind of ethnic partition, and I'm not sure this would quite be that, we can talk about that, but when you have clear ethnic partition, sometimes what it does is it allows each ethnicity to become secure in its identity, and then exactly that. It starts dealing with the other ethnicity as a state deals with a state, and you get economic interchange and so on, and they eventually let bygones be bygones. I have a question, though, about kind of about the ethnic map. I mean, when you bring up partition, sometimes people say, well, the landscape isn't so coherent, actually. I mean, for example, right in Damascus, you have these, a lot of Sunni in the city of Damascus.
It's overwhelmingly Sunni. I mean, even if Syria splits in half the way I've described it, the majority of the population in this Damascus West Coast state is going to be Sunni. The Alawites are going to be a minority in any situation unless they just take the West Coast off. The Alawites are a majority of the population on the West Coast. But that's mm-hmm. a very narrow, small state that would be unsustainable, because if you had a Sunni state in the rest of Syria, it would dominate the sources of income, oil, everything else, and would very rapidly probably devour this small rump state on the coast that was Alawite. So that's why Assad doesn't want to give up Damascus and all this other stuff. I mean, he sees himself as Syrian. That's why he's maintained this whole Ba'athist ideology that he's maintaining the nation. But ethnically, he can't sustain a viable Alawite state on the coast. It'd be too weak. It'd be too small. So he's struggling like mad to maintain as much as he can. Yes, it's unstable. No matter how you slice it, there's going to be tons of instabilities here. But I think something we have to think about is that people look for a power-sharing formula or some kind of truce to come about in the future. They look to Lebanon and the Taif Accord, and they look to Iraq between Sunnis and Shiites. And neither mm-hmm. of these are good models for Syria, because both of them required boots on the ground. Mm-hmm. In Lebanon, we can't forget that it was Syrian occupation of Lebanon in 1976, and Syria disarmed the various militias, all except for Hezbollah, which is still a problem for Lebanon. But it disarmed all the militias and forced them to go to Taif in Saudi Arabia and negotiate a central Lebanese state and reconstitute it. But that's because they had their guns taken away from them. And in Iraq, the same thing. I mean, what America really did in Iraq, other than destroy Sunni power and put the Shiites on the top, is it suppressed all of the Shiite contenders for power, like mm-hmm. the Sadrist movement and so forth, and helped Maliki emerge as the dominant and centralized state. And it spent 8 years trying to train up a militia, you know, a military, and form these ministries, and helped him build a state so that when they left, he could hold on to power. And that hasn't worked very well because he has completely marginalized the Sunnis, and we see this. Sunnis have become radicalized once again. They're joining al-Qaeda in droves, and they're blowing up Shiites like mad, almost 1,000 a month. Mm-hmm. And the civil war is still going on in Iraq. So there is no foreign boots on the ground in Syria to disarm the militias and help build a central state, to force the different sides to share power. And that makes one fearful that both Assad and the rebels would prefer to divide the country in two than to reach a compromise solution that would mean the end of their rule.
Well, and it sounds like if you don't have boots on the ground from some dominant foreign power, that then the argument for that kind of partition is that much stronger. You'd still face a problem, you know, rendering governance coherent on the rebels' side, on their territory. Right. But still, I mean, it sounds like if you don't have foreign boots on the ground, partition makes all the more sense.
It does. I mean, the logic, because neither side has an interest in compromise. Assad wants to rule Syria. He would mm-hmm. prefer to rule over half of Syria with his family firmly in power and his structure, you know, his government's, the regime structure in place. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The rebels, in any kind of compromise, are going to demand that the Assad family go, which is a non-starter for the Assad family, and it means that probably that Alawite power unravels and so forth. Assad's never going to accept that. He would prefer just to keep what he has and to discard the rest of Syria. Right. Than to make any deep compromise. And the rebels will be the same way. They wanted a Sharia state. They want Sunnis to rule. This is a non-starter with Assad. You know, neither of them wants to accept. They don't want the old Syrian army on top of their heads the way it used to be, killing them. So it's hard to see how you get compromise without a foreign power sort of shoving it down their throats.
So, yeah, and nobody's volunteering for that job, and the U.S. is not going to volunteer for it. So in that sense, The stated U.S. goal of a negotiated solution without partition is just almost nonsensical.
Well, you know, what is America going to do? Say, let them fight it out, which is what they're
Well, and maybe they feel they can't say they're in favor of partition, but it seems to me like if there's a goal that they actually should be pursuing, it's probably partition.
Well, but that's what they are pursuing. I mean, in a sense, the unstated goal is, which is leaving the two powers, you know, two sides equally balanced, not favoring one over the other in any dramatic way, punishing one when it goes too far, that leads to partition. And it's, you know, they don't want to say it because it's everybody will object. But in a sense, by not weighing in, you're letting a new balance of power between Syria's ethnic groups emerge. And that's what we're seeing. You know, in Iraq, America gave a total win to the Shiites. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't want to do that in this case. It doesn't want to give a total win to the Sunnis in Syria. It thought about doing it, and I think it wanted to do it at first when it believed that this movement was dominated by middle class young people who wanted reform and not radical mm-hmm. Islam and so forth. But as the Islamists, you know, pushed themselves forward and became the dominant militias on the ground, America backed away from that position and has now thrown up its hands and sort of trying to stay out of it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, at some point, presumably, if partition is anybody's stated or unstated goal, it would make sense for outside powers to actually encourage it. It actually needs to become a kind of explicit goal, right? And But do you think it's actually...
It does, but it contradicts, you know, America and Obama very dramatically said that Assad cannot stay. They have drawn a line through him. And if they encourage partition, they're saying Assad can stay. And in a sense, you know, Obama almost admitted this about a month ago when not him, but Carney, his spokesperson, White House spokesperson, came out and said that Assad will never rule all of Syria again.
Mm.
And that was a very telling statement because it
that's
was a big,
an adjustment. That's an adjustment of rhetoric.
Yes, yeah. A big climb down from the initial Assad's got to go. Mm-hmm. And now it was Assad's got to go. He's not going to regain the territory he's lost. And America will see to it that he doesn't. Mm. So in a sense, it was a veiled admission of partition.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Now, do you think it's too early for partition to happen? In other words, do the two sides just have to fight a little more? Do you even maybe need for the ethnic map to become more coherent, although that generally entails horrible stuff because it means that people are so imperiled that they have to flee? Or do you think, in principle, if outside powers were willing to admit that this is their goal, do you think in principle we could start working toward partition right now?
Look, if the rebels don't accept the idea of partition, Assad doesn't accept the idea of partition. Both sides still think that they can conquer the whole bloody country.
Mm-hmm.
The Saudis don't agree with it. The Arab League constitutionally against the idea of a Sykes-Picot II, as it's called. The whole region is allergic to the notion of dividing up Assyria, in the same way they were about Iraq being divided up. Nobody accepts this. Even the Turks have come out and said, we won't accept a Kurdistan in the north of Syria, northeast. So everybody's against it. And it's, you know, according to the UN, it's illegal to divide a country up unless there's sort of constituted, recognized governments that everybody can get behind. And there aren't such a thing in Syria. So we really are hamstrung by all of this, by the diplomacy of the region and the UN standards. A lot is going to have to change on the ground and emerge over time with distinct governments that are ready to talk peace.
Okay. But I gather one thing you're saying or implying is that I'm getting a little echo of myself. Are you still hearing me okay?
I am hearing you okay.
Okay. Although a lot of Sunnis live within the area that you imagine Assad governing in a partition solution, that is feasible in the long run, you're saying? I mean, it's not as if all the Sunnis have to leave for governance to become viable. In principle, Assad, even after all this, could rule a state that included a lot of Sunnis.
Yes. I mean, he's done it for 40 years. They all speak Arabic. They all, you know, eat tabbouleh. They aren't that different.
Mm-hmm.
What they need to do, you know, boy, it's very hard to say how that would work out because this regime has been very brutal. It's been very sectarian. It's privileged the Alawites at the top of the heap in the security forces. And you know, the Alawites are still poor. You can't say that they've made them rich. They get the pick of the government jobs and so forth. And the Sunnis still dominate the economy. They're better educated. They have much better links to the outside world and to the Arab world in general. So they're the richer of the two groups. But, you know, they could live together. It's hard to see how it works because you look at the Ghouta and the problems today of Assad trying to contain the Sunni uprising in Damascus. It's not a done deal in any way, shape, or form, and it's still being, in a sense, negotiated with all this terrible killing. I mean, it's a hard, you know, you don't want to use the word negotiated because it covers up the brutality of this effort. So we don't know how it's going to work out.
Okay. Does Iran, in principle, if we were to welcome Iran into the discussion about Syria, and we have so far excluded Iran from involvement, would that help in either the seemingly unlikely negotiated solution scenario or in the partition scenario? Is it important or constructive for Iran to become part of the
Iran
conversation?
Iran has major interests, and they're pouring in weapons, and they're giving money, and you know. Thinking that you can just cut Iran out of the equation is I think, is silly. Although there are many people, every time I go to Washington to talk or any kind of a forum, a consultation, I'm always sitting across from some friend of mine who's arguing, this is the opportunity. America cannot allow Hezbollah and Iran to be part of the equation in Syria any longer. We can destroy them. And that, you hear it in Washington all the time. So Washington is still laboring under, I think, the hope that at the end of the day, they can destroy Hezbollah and get rid of Iranian influence from Syria altogether. Of course, you know, the trouble is that means killing the Shiites and wiping them out, because as long as there's Shiites in both these countries, they're going to look to Iran for aid and help and so forth. And so I don't see it as realistic, and I don't think it's in America's interest to be getting into this Shiite versus Sunni war. We don't want to give the Sunnis a total win over the Shiites, and we have to accept that there are Shiites, that they're going to look to Iran. The problem is, of course, is that we've got such bad blood between us and the Iranian regime, and the Iranian regime, as it stands today, is very anti-American, is looking for a way to hurt us in many different ways, and we're very anti-Iran. I mean, it's our national goal is regime change. And we spend a lot of money to try to further those goals mm-hmm. every year. So it's hard to see how we sit down with Iran. And Iran is developing nuclear weapons. It threatens Israel. And Israel's our, you know, how do we get over all those things?
Right. But you can imagine our desire to solve that problem actually helping on the other front. In other words, you know, it's if we sit down and it seems within reach to actually get a negotiated solution to the nuclear issue, that could, in principle, facilitate engagement.
It could.
More broadly.
It could, if you're willing to negotiate all these things. And it doesn't look like we're anywhere near that point.
No, it doesn't, which is not to say that it's rational not to be willing to do that. But I agree that there isn't yet a clear evidence that we're willing. One final before we go, to get back to the seemingly imminent and by the time this airs, possibly ongoing military strike against Syria. It has been said that the administration is certainly not going to try to, you know, they're not looking for regime change with this strike. They're not trying to turn the tide of the war. But is there any way in which the existence of the civil war could affect the target list? I mean, in other words, I would imagine that in principle, if this were doable, if Obama could hit Syrian targets that lead to advances just for particular rebel factions that meet with our approval and right. aren't Al-Qaeda, right? In other words, it increased the relative power within the rebel movement of people we approve of. I would imagine he might take the opportunity to do that. But is there any reason to think that the kind of landscape of target lists or the landscape of the Civil War in general is clear-cut enough to do that?
Well, you can't really micromanage it. What you can do is tilt the balance a little bit. And in any kind of a disciplinary strike like this, deterrent strike, you've got to change the balance of power. That's the only thing that hurts Assad is when you degrade his power relative to the rebel forces. So America's going to take him down a notch. Obviously, they don't want to take him down so far that the rebels, you know, sweep into mm-hmm. Damascus and take the chemical weapons. But they do want to scare him.
Right.
So that he won't use, you know, he'll in the mm-hmm. future, he'll think, geez, I shouldn't use these chemical weapons again. Because if he does use them again, then America gets sucked into the Civil War because we have to whack him again. And it you know, it becomes an ongoing thing for the United States. And so, you know, that's where, boy, you know, that's where you get into this slippery slope and everything is a little up in the air. You know, already the effect on the Syrian regime of America's decision to hit him has been profound. I mean, the morale in Damascus has gone through the floor. The rebels are very encouraged. Lots of people are leaving Damascus of all kinds, particularly people wealthy enough to get out. Most of them had gone, but there's still a lot who reading life, you know, not normally, but not unnormally. And they're headed for Lebanon and everywhere else. And the regime has had to move everybody out of their major government buildings. They've hidden all their weapons in different places so they won't get destroyed. I mean, this has made a lot of self-doubt amongst the regime and a lot of encouragement amongst the rebels. So even if he ends up hitting a bunch of empty buildings, the regime is going to think long and hard whether they want to go through this every, you know, so often. It's psychologically, it's been a real blow to the regime.
Mm-hmm. And you don't imagine Obama trying to use the strikes in an even more fine-grained way and alter the balance between the quote good rebels and the quote bad rebels.
You know, which way that they can improve their position and the position of their allies amongst the rebels and so forth. The trouble with Syria is and that they've had from the beginning is that they really aren't in control of the situation on the ground, and they don't feel at all confident that they can sculpt the, you know, local geography and the social geography into their favor. Otherwise, they'd be moving into this in a much bigger way, mm-hmm. with more money and more confidence. And they haven't shown any of that confidence so far, and they haven't had any successes. I mean, for 2.5 years, we've been trying to unify the opposition, bring about the seculars, and Islamism is getting more and more stronger and stronger. The rebel forces that are on the right and allied either to Al-Qaeda or Salafist jihadists are much stronger than they were in the beginning. So things have been moving in the wrong direction for the United States amongst the rebels. Even as the rebels get stronger, America's turning away from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, because as they get stronger, the constitution of the rebel movement is seemingly growing more and more adverse to U.S. interests. Okay, well, listen, thanks so much for taking the time, Joshua. It's a really good time to get your input on this.
To talk to you. This is a great program, very smart.
Okay, well, I hope you'll be back again then, although I hope the occasion will be less grim.
Bye-bye. Yeah.
Okay, all right. See ya.